Philosophy Talk is more than just pun and games.
Hume, do you think, was the greatest philosophical punster?
I really can't say.
I don't get it.
To understand puns is to understand misunderstanding, a worthy philosophical goal.
John and Ken walk down the street. John walks into a bar. Ken ducks.
I don't get it.
If Nietzsche thought he was Jesus, would he say, God is dad?
I don't get it.
Existentialist puns are a lost art.
I don't get it.
Kant, Fichte, and Hegel are playing cards. They all say, ideal.
I don't get it.
John, aren't puns just some antics?
No, they rise to the level of semantics.
In the age of information overload, layering in several meanings is key to capturing and holding people's attention.
Our guest is John Pollock, author of The Pun Also Rises.
More than just pun and games.
I don't get it.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner at Stanford, where Ken teaches philosophy and I did for 40 years.
40 wonderful years, John. And now today's topic is puns. We're calling the episode More Than Just Pun and Games.
Ken, there's a current events angle to this show.
Oh, how so?
Well, didn't you find the Democratic Convention hilarious?
Oh, God, John, that's awful. You need to stick to philosophy, dude. You need to stop trying so hard to be a political pundit.
Not bad, Ken, not bad.
So, look, John, I like puns as much as the next guy, but I'm not sure they're all that philosophically interesting, so I'm going to pass. No, I'm going to punt the ball to you so you can explain why they're interesting.
I think any student of language should love puns. Most are based on the interplay of sound and meaning, on ambiguity and misunderstanding the very stuff of most philosophy.
Well, I grant those are interesting topics. I grant you that.
Plus, there's the interesting question of why some people like me love puns and others like you, well, let's say, are less enamored of them.
Well, that's psychology, though, not philosophy. What I want to know, I love psychology, but what I want to know is, are there any philosophical ideas or theories that are, you know, essentially based on puns?
Well, yeah. I mean, some are. And it goes beyond philosophy. Puns in poetry, politics, all over. Some people even claim that puns were crucial to the development of civilization.
Oh, come on. Crucial to the development of civilization? Surely you jest. Puns are just trivial wordplay.
Well, didn't you ever hear of the Punic Wars between Rome and Carthage? At any rate, not any old wordplay counts as a pun, and they aren't always trivial.
Okay, so tell me, Mr. Wise One, what's so special about puns so I can start thinking about how they might have influenced civilization?
A pun is a joke exploiting the different possible meanings of a word, or the fact that there are words that sound alike but have different meanings.
So you're reading your dictionary now, right? So
yeah.
Puns are sort of like linguistic analogs of optical illusions, if your dictionary definition is right, except that instead of seeing the same object in two different ways, in a pun, you understand the same word in two different ways.
Well, yes, puns are wordplay, but not all wordplay counts as puns, depending on where you want to draw the line. Shakespeare has Romeo saying, Juliet is the sun. That's a play on words, but it's more a metaphor than a pun.
You said that puns are jokes. That the dictionary says that. But do puns really have to be funny? Think of Roosevelt. I think it's a pun on fear. We have nothing to fear except fear itself. That's not funny.
Well, I tend to agree with you that puns don't have to be funny, but I don't think that's a very good example because I'm not sure that's a pun.
Well, isn't it kind of a grammatical pun, like Oscar Wilde's pun in his title, The Importance of Being Earnest?
Well, I don't mean to quibble, but I'm not convinced about either of those.
Oh, well, look, okay, forget that. Back to my original question. Can you give me a single example, John, of a great philosophical idea based on a pun?
Well, think of Hume's term impression.
Well, I know that word. That's the word he used for sensations, like in vision and hearing and such, right?
Right. He distinguished between impressions, sensory things, and ideas, memories or recollections of those things. The term impression suggests the common sense view that sensory perception involves external objects literally pressing against our physical sense organs and leaving mental impressions of themselves behind.
Well, where's the pun in that, John? Let alone the fun. Where's the pun?
Yeah. Well, the pun is that Hume doesn't accept that picture at all. he doesn't think external objects are there to do the pressing. He's not even sure external objects make any sense. But he keeps the term impression and our common sense associations with it anyway to motivate his theory. He's punning in an ironic sort of way.
Well, that's cool. Hume as ironic punster. I never thought of him that way.
Puns can sneak up in all sorts of places. Think of Citizens United.
You mean the Supreme Court case that said that since corporations are persons, they have free speech rights and so can spend all the money they want on elections?
Yeah. At the heart of that decision, it seems to me, were puns on the word speech and person.
Oh, come on, John. You're saying this is one of the most momentous court decisions in recent history, and you're saying it turns on a play on words?
Well, yeah. I mean, it has to. I mean, you can look at all the mumbo-jumbo they quote from previous decisions, but in the end, it's just getting from a guarantee that human beings can say and think what they want. That's the Constitution, to the result that corporations, of all things, can spend all the money, of all things, that they want to influence elections. They had to be punning, however unwittingly, on two distinct meanings of the words person and speech. One meaning that applies to living, breathing organisms and what comes out of their mouths. Another that applies to disembodied legal fictions and what comes out of their coffers.
So you think they were making a deliberate joke? The Supreme Court was making a deliberate joke?
Well, I don't think it was a joke. I mean, the decision itself is sort of a joke, but the underlying pun, I'm sure that was pretty unwitting. It was kind of like what Wittgenstein called language on a holiday. But you can get into a lot of trouble when you go on holidays.
No, this,
it led to a deadly serious error in logic.
That's interesting, John. So now you got the idea of an unwitting pun. That's kind of a novel idea, I think.
I'm not aware that it's ever been treated in a novel, but it's kind of a new idea. All the more reason we philosophers need to pay attention to puns. We need to ferret out the sometimes unwitting ones and expose the subtle tricks they can play on the human mind.
And to give us a sample of those subtle tricks, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shuka Kalantari, to see how regular people think about puns. She files this report.
A pun can be a sign of high intelligence and wit, or the lowest form of humor, depending on who you ask. But in some cases, punning is a sign that you have a brain disorder. Here's Lionel of the podcast Lionel Nation to explain.
The disease is called Witzelsucht, an actual neurological disorder marked by excessive facetiousness and inappropriate or pointless behavior, or uncontrollable tendency to make puns. The patient nevertheless finds these utterances intensely amusing.
Witzelsucht is a real disease, no joke. But it's super rare, so don't go diagnosing your friends. In most cases, puns simply make us chuckle or roll our eyes. And sometimes, the same pun can have both effects.
I would like to make a pun about philosophy, but I can't.
That one's Louise. To me. I wondered why the baseball was getting bigger. Then it hit me. Also not so bad. That one's not so bad either.
I'm reading a book about anti-gravity. It's impossible to put down.
Something about the wording is not quite right.
Where do fish go on vacation?
Finland.
That's nice, simple, and stupid.
It's terrible.
Have you ever tried to eat a clock? It's very time-consuming. Sounds good. I like stupid jokes.
See, I don't like that one. It doesn't flow. Of course, you never tried to eat a clock.
No comment.
So what makes a pun a good pun? Are there criteria?
They're never really good. A good pun is terrible. A good pun makes you cringe.
I think a good pun is worded well and snappy.
Sometimes the funny part about a good pun is how unfunny it is.
Confusing. I think puns are dumb humor. And that's about its just simple dumbness.
You don't have to talk about it. You don't have to explain it. You just get it.
I think a pun is more successful when it comes out of a normal conversation, as opposed to just reading jokes off of popsicle sticks.
I think puns should definitely be funny, or they should be witty, at least. Like, there should be some wit.
Back in Shakespearean times, puns weren't supposed to be funny. They were simply a smart play on words. But 400 years later, much of the wordplay is lost to us because of shifts in the English language. Take A Midsummer Night's Dream. In one scene, two actors are pretending to be star-crossed lovers, and one kills himself while saying, "Die, die, die, die." Demetrius, who is watching the play, responds, "No die, but an ace for him." Get it? Me neither. I looked it up. An ace here refers to the number one, like ace of spades. But at the time, it was pronounced like the word ass, as in donkey. That hardly makes any sense in the 21st century. What makes a pun good changes with time. And even with modern puns, in the end, it's really personal taste. Ultimately, if you think a pun is good, if it makes you smile, then that is its own reward. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
Thanks to our roving reporter. In me, some of those puns really shook a funny bone. I'm John Perry. With me is my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor.
And today we're thinking about puns. It's more than just pun and games. We're joined now by John Pollock. He's a journalist. He's a former speechwriter for President Bill Clinton. He's the winner of the 1995 O. Henry Punoff World Championship. He's author of The Pun Also Rises. Now, how the humble pun revolutionized language, changed history, and made wordplay more than semantics. John, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks for having me.
So, John, two quick questions. First one, how did you get so interested in puns? And the second one, you were Clinton's speechwriter. You're really interested in language and meaning and ambiguity. So are you the one that wrote the part where he says it all depends on the meaning of is?
Second question first, nothing to do with that. And the first question, where did I get interested in puns, is actually family lore. As the story goes, I was slow to speak. I had individual words, but my mom was wondering, gosh, he's just not so quick to make sentences. And I walked into the kitchen without my shoes on. And she said, "Johnny, go put on your shoes. I don't want you walking in the kitchen barefoot." And I looked up at her and I giggled and I said, "Bears go barefoot."
That was your first sentence.
And at age two, I was often punning.
Well, you're off to a fast start. Now, I gave Ken a definition of a pun that I got after lots of research by hitting the dictionary button on my laptop. Have you got a better definition of puns than I gave Ken?
Well, the beautiful thing about puns is that they take so many different forms and that they defy easy categorization. You've got different types like a Wellerism, such as, "I see," said the blind man as he picked up his hammer and saw.
Yeah.
Or a Tom Swifty, "I definitely need another load of mulch," the gardener repeated.
Or wait. Go ahead while I think about it.
Yeah.
Okay. A spoonerism, if you need to shovel some more peat. You've got, "I'd rather have a bottle in front of me than a frontal lobotomy."
Okay. You can give us all kinds of examples. You're a world pun champion.
So there's all these subcategories.
Right.
The easiest definition is probably the use of a word in such a way that it can be interpreted with more than one meaning. But I want to get at something here that you've talked about. Puns don't have to be funny. Brunch is a pun. It's breakfast and lunch became brunch. Smog is smoke and fog. And so this idea of puns having to be funny is a popular misconception.
No, there's something that you I never thought of brunch and smog as puns, but that's an interesting thing because now it sounds like puns have a creative use. That is, you can form new words by punning on old words. You know, by putting smoke and fog together, you get this new meaning. Nobody hears it as a pun. They just hear it as, but there was a punning exercise that created that. So you think puns have this kind of creative function?
Absolutely. They're actually humanity's first hyperlink that take you leaping from one topic to another and establish or assert associations between the two of them. Some of them stick, like brunch is very popular. The squiggle, which came out a few years ago from one of these chains that was a square bagel, that didn't really take.
I was wondering because I'm like, what's that? the proof is in the pudding.
Do you suppose the word philosophy started out as a pun? Somebody looked at Socrates and said, "I guess he has full O for Sophie or whatever it was, and everybody laughed, but then it just became a word, huh?
They never had gotten, they didn't get their fill of ideas, so they had to keep asking questions.
Yeah,
so, exactly. So now there's a lot to dig in here. You make some big claims on behalf of puns, and we're going to see if we can put those big claims to the test. But you're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about more than just pun and games.
In the next segment, we'll consider whether puns are just amusing wordplay or something of deeper intellectual and historical significance.
More fun with puns. When Philosophy Talk continues.
So I pulled into a Shell station. They said I'd blown a seal. I said, fix the damn thing and leave my private life out of it, okay, pal? While they were doing that, I walked over to a place called the Oyster Bar, a real dive. But I knew the owner. He used to play for the Dolphins. I said, hi, Gil! You have to yell, he's hard of hearing.
That's Wet Dream by Kip Adada. Something fishy about that singer, probably a Pisces working for scale. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and we're thinking about puns.
Our guest is John Pollock. He's a championship punster and also author of This Pun Also Rises.
Now, John, you've made some pretty big claims about puns in your books, like that they revolutionize language and change history. I want to put this to the test. Can you give me an example of a pun that played a major role in human history or why I should believe this at all anyway?
Sure. Let's take one of the most important inventions, intellectual inventions in human history, which is the phonetic alphabet. Think about hieroglyphs and how limiting they are. They're great for nouns. You need to draw the sun. You draw a picture of the sun or carve it. You want to do a chariot, you do a chariot. But it's much more difficult to deal with abstractions and tenses and things that are really interesting to philosophers and everyday commerce and religion. And the scribes of ancient Mesopotamia and Egypt were big punsters. And what they realized around 1700 BC was that they could break off the phonetic value of different hieroglyphs and just use them for their sound. And they used that to invent history's first phonetic alphabet with 20-something characters. It's called the North Semitic alphabet. And suddenly they could write down ideas of infinite complexity very easily. And what did that let them do? It let them pass on knowledge. And
Wait a minute. You got to slow down.
Progress started.
So were they punning in hieroglyphics when they broke off? I mean, not quite. Where did the punning part come in that story that you just told?
When I set out to explore the history of puns, I had no idea that they were so important. I just thought they were a lot of fun. But I, in the course of my research, I interviewed Richard Parkinson, who is the head Egyptologist at the British Museum. And puns are very, very common in Egyptian hieroglyphs. Again, they weren't necessarily meant to be funny. But they were meant to layer on meaning.
So
the Egyptians were punsters.
Is that because one hieroglyphic thing could carry multiple meanings and they sort of exploited that? Is that the idea?
Well, the idea was that it was very difficult. So you had, you know, thousands of characters. But what they started to do was to strip the phonetic value from the meaning and just salvage the sound and used the sound to record meaning. So that's how letters emerged, where certain hieroglyphs morphed into abstract symbols rather than literal symbols.
I got it.
So the punning with hieroglyphs would be like what we now think of as a rebus, where you might, you know, say so-and-so's son, and then you might have a picture of the son, and you're supposed to figure out that it's son. And I suppose you could say, well, rebuses aren't as funny and easy to come up with as puns, so that's why we invented the phonetics alphabet, and all of its other advantages are kind of ancillary to that. Is that the idea?
Well, the phonetic alphabet was invented because it was necessary and useful to convey more information more efficiently, and it allowed many more people to become literate and to pass that knowledge on over time. But what you see in today is in text messaging, people do all the emoticons. That's going back to a type of visual punning that is conveying complex ideas in a semicolon and a parenthesis as a wink, for example.
So to summarize, what about that? So the ancient Egyptians started punning.
And the Babylonians. I don't want to shortchange the Babylonians.
No, we don't want to do that. Not these days.
Because they Babylon.
Yeah, they Babylon.
I knew that was coming. Yeah. I knew that was coming.
So by punning in hieroglyphics, it forced them to attend to the difference between sound and meaning, and that's a big step.
Yeah, but that...
Well, I won't say it forced them, but I would say that the smartest among them realized that there was a better way than literalism,
right.
and that this move toward abstraction would free them from the shackles of chiseling so many characters into stone.
And then once that happened, it sounds like you think, tell me if I'm following this wonderful detective story. Once that happened, all heck broke loose, that is, because once you divorce, once you make meaning... the relationship between meaning and sound more complex, the possibilities of one sound carrying multiple meanings, right, just open up exponentially? Is that?
The idea is that you've suddenly given people better Legos to construct things out of. Instead of having 50,000 different pieces of Legos, each one different with 50,000 distinct meanings, as you go to 20-something Legos and they all snap together and you can put them together in any way you want to capture all those meanings and more.
So let me ask you a question about that, because I want to go back to the smog thing for really quickly. Because I found it informative that you said that word originated in pun.
The word smog.
The word smog, for example. But one doesn't hear it as a pun anymore. One just hears it as a word for car-generated, industry-generated air pollution. You don't hear the punning. Is a lot of language like that? That's sort of like, I would call it a dead pun. I mean, it originated as a pun, but it's no longer used in a punning way. Is a lot of language like that? It has its origin in something like punning, would you say?
I would say that the meaning associated with specific words is constantly changing. The word cheesy, for example, we associate, that's a cheesy pun. But cheesy used to mean in the 1850s, really cool, fine, excellent, in style. And that's so what words intrinsically have no meanings except those we assign to them. And so you're right that we don't think of smog as a pun or brunch as a pun, but indeed puns are an engine of progress.
Well, that's
in language and elsewhere.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about puns with John Pollack. We'd love to have you join this conversation. We've got Michael from Boston on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Michael.
Yes, it wasn't my main thrust, but I do have to mention that pretty much every name in the Hebrew Bible is a pun of one sort or another, and that actually in biblical exegesis, I'm not pronouncing it properly, in Talmud, very often wordplay is used to try to find meanings of text when they're not clear. So, for example, the commandment not to plow the corners of the field and the commandment not to round the corners of your face are considered to be connected. So the beard is supposed to remind you to do charity. The actual philosophical question that may ride on a pun is... it's a matter of contention among Marxists, of which I'm not one, but I'm interested in it. And in the Communist Manifesto, Marx and Engels refer to the idiotismus of rural life. And in German, idiotismus at the time meant what it meant for the Greeks, essentially, which was self-absorption or isolation, uninterestedness in the outside world. But Marx and Engels were both fluent in English, so the question is, were they also trying to say idiocy?
I don't know. That's a good question. John Pollack, what do you think about that? Both those erudite points of Michael's, or either of those erudite points of Michael's?
I think that he's spot on. And in fact, if you look at the book of Job, There's a great number of puns in the original language, not in translation in English, but there's a great analysis of all the Janus parallelisms in there. And a Janus parallelism is a type of pun where it's a structure where a word is used in such a way as to echo the meaning of the previous line and to preview the meaning of the line to come and to hold its own in the current sentence. And nobody could accuse the Book of Job as being ha-ha type humor. It might be dark humor.
Yeah, it's a great cosmic joke. Yeah, I get you. But look, that raises a question. So I think if you went to the – well, think back to Shuka's piece. All those people were evaluating these puns by how humorous or at least witty, but mostly humorous they were. I think if you ask most people, puns are – and the dictionary definition that times it – are jokes. When did that happen? When did it become the case that to pun is to make a kind of joke rather than – because it doesn't – in Job and Shakespeare and all that stuff – In the Egyptians, that wasn't about joking. It was about extending meaning and playing on words, and sometimes for very serious purposes.
And sometimes showing off. But
yeah.
Not being funny.
When did this funny thing come about?
Well, puns got kicked to the curb of humor gradually, and it happened really post Enlightenment when categorization and science took root, and people wanted clear definitions, distinct boundaries, and definite categories. And puns are very unruly, and they'd always jump the fence of the pens erected around them. And so they fell out of favor with the rise of the Age of Reason.
Wow, that's interesting. So there's sort of the rise of scientific rationality. I mean, because that's one of the things that happened in philosophy, not so much puns, but metaphors used to have a more prominent place in philosophical thinking and writing. When the rise of rationality and logicism and all that stuff, metaphorical language kind of got, as you say, kicked to the curb. So that's an interesting moment in human history.
Well, a lot of philosophy really is the investigation into cases where it's not obvious that there's something like punning going on. Like, take Zeno's paradoxes. People have thought about those for thousands of years, and the analysis always says, well, there's, you know, two different meanings of motion here, or two different meanings of movement, or something like that. So I guess the more you're forced to think about the difficulties that come up in thinking because of ambiguity, the less funny you find ambiguity. Or the less charming, I should say. So you kick it into the joke area.
Right, right. You got a thought about that?
There's a great story about Samuel Johnson, who did the first major English dictionary. And he set out to write the dictionary. He had investors. He thought it would take him 3 years. And then it led to 4 and 5 and 6. And the debtors were trying to break into his place to reclaim his possessions, and it took him 9 years. Mm. He hated puns, absolutely hated them, because he was all about defining things and corralling multiple meanings and boiling things down. And so when he became famous as a result of the dictionary, he went on a rampage against puns and essentially, in writing about Shakespeare, said, listen, Shakespeare was great except for all those puns.
Oh, wow. Jeepers.
But, of course, he made them himself.
Well, there you go. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about puns with John Pollack, a world champion of puns, an author, a speechwriter for former President Clinton. We've got a caller, Bert from Berkeley. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Bert.
Thank you very much. My mind just seems to work in puns. Those are reactions. I don't always disclose them. But I did think of one the other day, which was about a beautiful woman named Denise, and she's from Prague, and she had an operation, and she became Dennis. And people would ask, you know, whatever happened to Denise? And the answer was, the check is in the mail.
Oh my God.
Pretty good. That's Bert from Bart, you know.
John, you like
Let's
that?
Let's give him credit for that.
Yeah. You think he could compete in one of those competitions of yours?
Listen, that's what we call a shaggy dog story, mm-hmm. and that's another great type of pun with a strong tradition throughout history.
I gather puns are making some kind of comeback, but there's this story I read recently. This happened a couple years ago in China. There's some pun, I can't remember the phrase, but the Chinese government was trying to censor pornographic sites, and there's this, and as a protest, millions of people apparently use this pun that in Chinese sounded like something that had a double meaning. It has a straightforward meaning. It was some animal or something, but it also had a pornographic meaning because it sounded like something, some other character. I mean, so puns can be used as acts of subversion even. There wasn't any humor in that. It was like a protest.
I think you just did a meta pun, right? Or something like that. You told all about a pun except what the pun was.
Yeah, because I can't remember what the pun was.
Well, a lot of puns don't survive translation, of course, but mm-hmm. what's going on in China is that there is a huge tradition of punning to get around censorship because the government can tell you what you can say and what you cannot say, but they can't tell you what you mean. And in fact, even in Shakespeare's time, one of his talents was to use puns to get around the royal censors. And there's been some significant studies by anthropologists that societies that are more rigid have more punning because it lets people talk about taboo subjects obliquely.
So in those kind of societies, is the act of punning as this act of resistance or protest or something, are those puns considered funny, or is it just that it doesn't matter that they're funny, it's just that they're double and that one of the meanings is permitted and one isn't?
It could be funny and it could be not funny. For example, during World War II, puns were used as code to instruct saboteurs in German-occupied Europe. And those puns weren't necessarily funny, but they were a way to signal and to discuss. And so this listen, I love funny puns, and while my wife will say that not all of my puns are funny, play is the essence of language. But we've got to break people's chains here. Puns are about multiplicity of meaning. You can use them in a funny context, and you can use them otherwise.
You know, I was just thinking of what it must be like to be your kid. Do you have a kid? And what does your kid think about all these puns that come out of your mouth?
Well, funny you should ask. My first son will be born in October, and I'm sure that he'll become an excellent punster.
Yes, I bet he will.
Or he'll resist puns like crazy. But you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about puns and wordplay with John Pollock, author of The Pun Also Rises.
In our next segment, why do some people love puns and others hate them? What does a person's reactions to puns say about that person?
The psychology of puns, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Well, the yellowtail was impressed with the way I landed her boyfriend. She came over to me, she said, "Hey, big boy, you're really a game fish. What's your name?" I said, "Marlin."
More wet dreams from Kip Adatta. Some of that was a bit hard to fathom, a little deep for me. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is John Pollock, author of The Pun Also Rises. We're thinking about more than just pun and games, and we've got a caller, Bill from San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Bill. What's your comment or question?
Well, hello.
Yeah, hello.
Go. Hi. glad to hear you talking about puns. I grew up with Rocky and Bullwinkle, and that worked for both kids, because they're two dumber than rocks types, and it works for adults, and especially when they went to the end of the episode where they had, Rocky and Bullwinkle go to Panama or I'm Dreaming of a Wide Isthmus. but things like, Mae West. Mae West, the double entendres that she used and and puns that she used, as well as people like, you know, any comedians, W.C. Fields, or, you know, because it takes you one way and then it hooks you the other way.
Got some examples?
No, not offhand. Well, this is one way that, you know, you talk about signals and you talk about double meanings, as well as, you know, how new generations use slang or expression. I ran into someone whose name, his kid's name, and I had a laugh, was Kush, which is about pot.
Oh.
But it's really about the Kush Mountains.
Ah.
You know, so I had a laugh. You know, he knew what I was talking about. But
so, Bill, I'm going to put it to John. I'm going to draw a question out of your, because you referred to double entendre. Bill referred to double entendre. That can be taken at two different levels, right? The kid's way, they hear the funny joke, but the adults hear the sexual innuendo or something. Is that punning, or is that something different? How's it related? Is that just is that a sophisticated use of punning? What do you think about that?
Well, double entendres are a whole category of puns, and I think sometimes double entendres are wordplay. But again, the overlap between puns and wordplay is very significant, and I'm not as concerned about the borders. But what they do is they let you get around the censors. And so if you're talking about SpongeBob SquarePants living in Bikini Bottom, the adults get that, and the kids don't. And
right.
if you're looking at a James Bond movie, and you know he's, you know, going at it with pussy galore,
then you
switch to Austin Powers, and you know he's dealing with Ivana Humpalot, and so there's puns on puns, and so there's a lot of depth to the double entendre, and I think we should celebrate that.
So John, we promised we would talk about the psychology of puns in this segment, and I think we should, although the more I think about it, the high point of the show may have been Bert from Berkeley, and the check is in the mail. I can't keep thinking about that original pun. But I love puns, and so do you. Ken, I think, likes puns, but love may be a bit strong for his attitude. Some people just find them despicably unfunny abuses of language and good taste. We heard from Shuka about some kind of mental disease, whose name I don't remember, that leads people to just make incessant punning. So what's known, and what do you think about the psychology of punning and punsters?
I think that there are good puns and there are bad puns, just like there are good restaurants and bad restaurants, good elected officials and bad elected officials. And it's important not to dismiss an entire category because there are some bad ones in the lot. If you said, I don't like apples because there's an occasionally a rotten apple, you'd have no apple pie. And where would America be without apple pie? So that's one point. The second thing is that people who are more comfortable with ambiguity tend to like puns more because puns are by their nature ambiguous. That's their fuel. And if you're a rules guy, you're not going to like puns as much, probably.
Could you tell by looking at somebody, if I could put somebody on a brain scan and I could say, oh, this person's going to hate the pun because there's some fact about his brain that explains. I mean, we all have to deal with that ambiguity. The brain is designed, I would think, to interpret signals. So we all have to deal with ambiguity. But is there something about the brain, like the neural chemistry, the neural architecture of the brain that explains why there's a difference between people in this regard?
Well, I think that if you take it one level deeper and say, where would we be if we couldn't separate meaning, what someone says from what they mean? And we think about knock-knock jokes as being simple. So, knock-knock.
Who's there?
Isabel.
Isabel who?
Isabel necessary on a bicycle? So we think, oh, that's a simple kid's joke. But really, it's a very complex operation, which is to strip off the meaning, take the phonetic chunks and rearrange them and apply a new meaning, and to do that really quick. And when kids start playing with language in this way, and knock-knock jokes exist in many different languages in similar form, it's learning to separate, you know, how do you listen to something and how do you draw meaning from what you're hearing, even if it's not explicitly stated. And that skill is one of the most valuable in life.
So I'll ask you a relevant question, which you may be honor-bound not to answer, but who likes puns better, Hillary or Bill?
Well, I'm not in a position to say because I've worked very closely with the president and I have not yet worked with the president-to-be. But he loves language. And in fact, the fact that I had won the World Pun Championship was a significant factor in my getting hired there over somebody else who was equally qualified with perhaps more experience. And in fact, I have the decision memo framed in which he has marked up the memo saying, we'd like to hire this guy as your speechwriter or one of your speechwriters. And the only thing he wrote on it was he circled World Pun Champion and wrote good exclamation mark in the margin. Now, here's the kicker. Many years later, I was speaking with an archivist at the Clinton Library, at the Presidential Library, and she said, note how this is comment is in pencil. And I did, and I hadn't thought of that before, but he always marks things up in Sharpies when he edits speeches. And she said, because it's in pencil, he was probably doing a crossword puzzle at the time.
Well, duh.
So there you have it. That's fate at work.
So just a commentary before we go to a caller. I do notice that Hillary loves puns that involve the word Trump.
Well, yeah. We've got a caller who can help us out with the Chinese thing that I referred to. PC from Redwood City. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, PC.
Hey, thanks. I'm in a kind of a noisy cow train, so bear with me. And I want to start with a quick restaurant pun, since John mentioned it earlier, which was last week some friends and I went to Chinatown. And the husband enjoyed the peking duck, but the wife was horrified to see the bill.
Anyway, so help me out with that thing that I referred to that I couldn't remember, PC.
No, I mean, speaking of bill, I mean, for me personally, as someone who had to learn English later on in life, it was really crucial for me to understand that words have multiple meanings and try to figure out when I interpret or when presented a choice with Google Translate, which one to pick and what consequences there can be. The Chinese pun that was referred to earlier has its origins in the 1950s when the communist government really wanted to raise literacy. And they thought it was a really good idea to combine characters, to simplify characters in one, and also combine characters in homophones, even if they have different meanings. So there was a word which is gun, which means dried. There was a word that's called gun, which kind of looked the same, in which case it meant to do. And in a very vulgar vernacular sense, they combined the two. And so what happened a few years ago, this became famous when there was a sign of a department store in Shanghai where their dry goods department sign got translated in English as F your goods here. So that's become a really common pun whenever, you know, to do the censors, they will use, shall we say, dry sense of humor to overcome the censors.
Well, thanks for that insight, PC. That's really great. That really helps. I knew about that story, but I couldn't remember the details. But John, I'm going to give you, we're near the end here. Give us one last bit of insight about the importance of puns, this Chinese thing, if you want, or whatever your last thought is.
And one last really good pun.
Well, I can't promise a good pun, but I will leave people with this. And that is that all of human progress is driven by imagination. We try new associations. People banged rocks together. They got a spark. They lit a fire. They boiled water. They generated electricity, and suddenly we're talking on an iPhone. And it's this, these unlikely associations that, through experimentation, drive progress. And if we didn't make puns, we would not develop the muscles of imagination, of association. And so I would just tell people, pun with pride. It's the fuel of progress.
Well, John, thanks for that. This has been a great conversation, and you've convinced me, so I'm going to thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Our guest has been John Pollack. He's a journalist, former speechwriter for former President Bill Clinton. He's a pun champion and author of The Pun Also Rises, How the Humble Pun Revolutionized Language, Changed History, and Made Wordplay More Than Semantics. So, John, what pun thoughts are you thinking now?
I thought it was a good conversation. I'm thinking that we should try in philosophy, particularly in logic, philosophy of language, to use puns more to encourage students to find that they already have these skills of disambiguating. And the trick is to do it when it's not somebody trying to be funny, but someone trying to convince you of something that you really don't want to believe.
I think that's a good idea. I mean, Wittgenstein said philosophy rises when language goes on a holiday. He thought that was a bad thing, mm-hmm. right? But it may be a good thing because puns are, in a way, language going on a holiday. And John Pollack convinced us that that's part of the creative use of language. So take that, Wittgenstein.
Yeah, I agree.
So this punning conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto for this week is cogito ergo punno, I think, therefore I pun. You too can become a partner in that community just by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
Now, the fastest punster this side of Plato's cave, it's Ian Scholes, the 62nd philosopher.
Ian Scholes, when the old school James Bond killed a guy, he would arch an eyebrow and make a joke about it. That joke would often be a pun. Thunderball comes to mind when he shot a bad guy with a spear gun and then quipped, I guess he got the point. This actually became an action movie thing. I call them Little Jimmies because James Bond originated the meme. Heroes now have to make a wisecrack when they kill or knock out a guy. If they blow him up, they'll say, you got a bang out of that. Run his car over a cliff and say, buckle up for safety. Audiences get a kick out of these things. Also, people never get tired of the who's on first routine or Chico Marx refusing to sign a contract because he doesn't believe in sanity clause. We like funny names for stores, like calling a barbershop the clip joint. We like jokes like the one, for instance, when a woman tells her husband that the plumber came by and unplugged the pipes. But she's really talking about sex. Remember the radio show Car Talk? The whole list of the staff at the end was just hideous puns. Like the lawyers Dewey, Cheatham, and Howe. Remember fifth grade, reading books like Yellow River by I.P. Freely, Under the Grandstand by Seymour Butts. What is wrong with us? When we do parodies or porn versions of popular movies, there usually is a pun involved. Star whores, schlock homes. If you want to have a special on chicken wings at your pizza joint, when do you have it? On Wednesday, of course, or as they call it in the flyer, Wings Day. Do I need to explain that for you? The Beatles, Led Zeppelin, those are puns, aren't they? Remember Tales from the Crypt? It started out as a comic book in the 50s. Most of the horror stories hinged on some kind of horrible surprise ending that was usually pun-based. Like if you get attacked in the head by bats, the narration would say you really did have bats in your belfry. When it became a series on HBO, the Crypt Keeper, who hosted the show, became famous for his awful puns. If somebody was being devoured, he'd say, now we know what's eating him. One time he said, that's entertainment, which is really hard to say. Unless you say it, where are you? I guess we can take a certain amount of pride in the more complicated puns we've come up with over the years. Specifically, I would like to thank the joke that ends, the squaw of the hippopotamus is equal to the sons of the squaws on the other two hides. You groaned when you first heard it. You're groaning now. How about, it's a knick-knack, Patty Black. Give the frog alone, which again will take you right back to fifth grade. Then, of course, the puns of Shakespeare. I have been to Shakespeare plays where audience members laughed unconvincingly at Shakespeare's wordplay. They'd read the play once in college. They didn't really think it was funny, but laughed because they wanted everybody to know they get the joke. But you're only fooling yourselves. We don't know the difference between a halberd and a poniard, much less puns based on words that sound like them. If not a full-time etymologist, keep your knowing Shakespearean chuckle to yourself. I have mixed feelings about puns, as you can tell, but you can't stop them. I know that. And denial is a river in Egypt. Well, it's not really. That's the Nile. Denial is a psychological state in which the denier refuses to face reality. Denial, you might say, is the tunnel at the end of the light. See what I did there? If you did, let me know. And stop me before I do it again. Thank you. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University. Copyright 2016.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Dave McAllister is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Colin Peden, Merle Kessler, Erica Topeat, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Moe's Tavern, Moe speaking.
Yes, I'm looking for a Mrs. O'Problem, first name B.
Yeah, just a minute, I'll check. B O'Problem, B O'Problem. Come on, guys, do I have a B.O. problem here?